This is Here and Now. Despite a big Republican majority, lawmakers in New Hampshire today voted down a bill to make that state the 29th state with a so-called right-to-work law. House lawmakers killed the legislation, which was a defeat for Republican Governor Chris Sununu, who supported right-to-work. Right-to-work laws, which limit how unions collect dues, have already passed in Missouri and Kentucky this year, and they're coming at a time when union membership nationally is at an all-time low. Todd Bookman from Here Now contributor New Hampshire Public Radio reports.
He didn't make it a centerpiece of his campaign, but New Hampshire's newly elected Republican Governor Chris Sununu was more than eager to talk up right-to-work during his inaugural address.
We're going to give employees, once and for all, the flexibility they deserve in the workforce by passing right-to-work. And let's tell these companies New Hampshire is open for business.
For the first time in more than a decade, Republicans control the House, Senate, and governor's office in New Hampshire. And that's had union members worried. Broadly speaking, right-to-work policies prohibit unions from forcing workers to pay fees to cover the cost of collective bargaining. For Bobby Jones with AFSCME Local 3657, that upsets the labor management balance.
When we go to the table, it should be the employer and the employee together bargaining for a common good. And what this law will do is it will put government into that equation where they're not needed.
Opponents say right-to-work laws also create a problem known as free riding. Workers who don't chip in to cover the costs of collective bargaining still get the benefits of a union contract. And then there's the partisan angle of right-to-work. Many union members believe the laws are thinly veiled attempts by the GOP to weaken their power. Big labor traditionally backs Democratic candidates.
It's legislation that I think is more politically motivated and ideologically motivated than it really is motivated by the demand of businesses and the facts backing it up.
That's State Senator Donna Soucy, a Democrat who opposes the bill. But many of her GOP colleagues across the aisle back right-to-work laws. That includes Andy Sanborn. He says the concept of giving workers more choice is a natural fit in the live free or die state.
I believe very, very strongly, if somebody or a group of people want to come together and they want to be part of the union, I will fight for their right to do so. But that also dictates that I will fight equally as hard for those who do not want to be part of the union.
And Sanborn says it would give New Hampshire, where less than 10% of the workforce is unionized, a leg up as it works to attract businesses. There are no other states in the Northeast with right-to-work laws on the books right now.
If President Trump is successful in bringing all of this money back in and encouraging all this economic activity and manufacturing come to America, now we're going to have a plethora of companies looking to find their home base, and we want to make sure New Hampshire is actually in the hunt.
Both sides toss around competing statistics about right-to-work's impact, both on employee wages and overall growth. Russ Tebow argues the policy likely doesn't make or break a state's economy. He's with the New Hampshire firm Applied Economic Research.
It's true that you can find data to support either side of the debate, which says to me maybe the consequence of right-to-work is not that overwhelming.
But it does remain one of the most important political fights, one that can be expected to flare up again in other states as Republicans push for more right-to-work laws. For Here and Now, I'm Todd Bookman in Concord, New Hampshire.
Well, last year, only 1 in 10 workers belonged to a union. So let's talk more about right-to-work laws and how that's affecting unions across this country with Gordon Lafer, associate professor at the University of Oregon's Labor Education and Research Center and a research associate at the Economic Policy Institute. He's with us via Skype. Welcome.
Thanks. Good to be here.
And it does seem like, in general, the opponents of right-to-work are losing the battle.
That is absolutely true. And it's been true since 2011, which is when we got the first round of state legislatures that were elected post Citizens United, when there was a flood of corporate money into state politics, and that really changed a lot of the state legislatures.
And that had that big of an impact on this longstanding issue about unions?
The last state before this round of states that adopted a right-to-work law was Oklahoma in 2001. And before that, it's mostly in the 40s and 50s. It was really a dead issue. And then there was a tremendous amount of money that came into state politics that elected legislatures that took office in January of 2011. And that brought in a new wave of right-to-work laws in a bunch of different states.
Well, and back up for a second and just explain what right-to-work laws do.
Good, because it's a misleading name. I mean, first of all, it has nothing to do, unfortunately, with being a guaranteed a job if you're ready and willing and able to work. It also has nothing to do with anybody being forced to be a union member. It's already law, both in the private sector and the public, that nobody can be forced to be a union member, and nobody can be forced to pay any amount of dues to any political or charity or social cause they oppose. What is legal is that if the employer and employees agree, they can negotiate a contract which includes a requirement that everybody who benefits from the terms of a union contract pay their fair share of the cost of negotiating it and enforcing it. What right-to-work laws do is make it illegal to have that kind of agreement in a union contract. So that means that if you work someplace, what you're essentially told is you'll get all the benefits of a union contract for free. If something bad happens to you and you need the union to help you, they have to help you under law. But to pay your fair share of the costs of that is optional.
And so the result is that nobody pays the dues because they can get the same thing without paying.
Right. I mean, it's not nobody, but it's like if the government said to you, the part of your taxes that goes to pay for the fire department is now optional. If your house catches on fire, they'll still come and put out the flames. You don't have to be anti-fire department to not pay that. All you need is that times are tight, which they are for lots and lots of people, and somebody just told you that paying is optional. So the goal of these laws is to make unions financially unviable.
What are the protections that unions have given workers that you fear will be taken away?
Well, look, we're living in a crisis of inequality in America, and some of that is about money, is about wages. Some of it about access to health insurance and health insurance that you can afford. Some of it is about pensions. You know, I think what the American dream was for most people was not to be rich, but to be secure, like to not be afraid of being poor and desperate when you're old, to be able to provide something for your kids, to be able to either own your house or, you know, be secure in the place that you're living. That kind of security, I think, defines the dream of being middle class that people have sought for a long time in America. And that's getting harder and harder to attain for people, even though they're working more hours and they're getting more education. And a lot of that is because there are no unions. And so companies make a lot of profit, but companies are not charities. They're not going to share the profit with the people who work there unless they have to. And unfortunately, when there are no unions, in many, many places, what we see is corporate profits are up, executive salaries are up, but the wages and benefits of the people who do the work that make the profits are going down or staying flat.
And what do you say to people who point to studies that show that the right-to-work states have seen better income growth and lower unemployment than the non-right-to-work states?
Well, two things. One is it's just not true when you look at the data correctly, which is to say holding all other things equal. So people can say, oh, look, Texas is a right-to-work state and Michigan wasn't. And so if Michigan would pass right-to-work, it will have job growth like Texas. And they ignore all the other things going on in the economy. The fact that it's warm in Texas and they don't have snow days, the fact that they have oil under the ground, or they have a big military industry, or they have 500,000 people coming over the border from Mexico, which actually spurs on the economy. All other things being equal, what is the impact of passing a right-to-work law? The data is very, very clear that the impact is to lower wages and benefits for both union and non-union workers and to do nothing to boost job growth. And this is really a critical piece, and especially critical to see the connection between these laws passing in the states and the promotion by people now in Congress, and President Trump has spoken favorably about it, of having a national right-to-work law. What they say in each state is right-to-work is going to lower wages, and therefore our state will become more attractive for manufacturers who are trying to decide, do I want to be in Michigan or South Carolina or wherever? So first of all, that ship has really sailed. That might have been true in 40 years ago, but companies who are looking primarily for low wages now are going to China or Mexico or Vietnam. They're not going to South Carolina or Arizona. But even to the extent it's true, you know, if Missouri gets told, hey, pass a right-to-work law and we'll attract more companies that otherwise will go to Texas or Virginia, then you see the same business lobbies pushing a federal right-to-work law. Well, if the law is across the whole country, it means that no state will have a competitive advantage versus any other state. Nobody will have a reason to draw manufacturers from one place to another, and everybody will be making less and having less benefits.
So do you expect there will be a national right-to-work law soon?
Well, it's already been proposed. As I understand it, the Trump administration has made statements saying they're in favor of it. I assume that, you know, at this point, the power of the big corporate lobbies, which has really been the force behind these laws, I mean, the Chamber of Commerce, the American Legislative Exchange Council, the Koch brothers, the National Association of Manufacturers, those same lobbies are tremendously influential in the Congress and the Senate. I think, like other things, this is going to come down to, will the Democrats in the Senate filibuster this if it comes to them? And I don't know the answer to that.
That's Gordon Lafer, who is an associate professor at the University of Oregon's Labor Education and Research Center and a research associate at the Economic Policy Institute. His upcoming book is called The 1% Solution, How Corporations Are Remaking America One State at a Time. Gordon Lafer, thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much.
Today, China put carfentanil and three related opioids on a list of controlled substances. That drug, which is 10,000 times more powerful than morphine, is used as an elephant tranquilizer, and it's been responsible for a number of overdoses and deaths here in the United States. The Drug Enforcement Administration says today's news could be a game changer in the fight against opioids. Brian Spiegel is China correspondent at The Wall Street Journal. He's on Skype in Beijing. And Brian, why do people, including at the DEA, believe this could have such a big impact on the U.S. opioid epidemic?
Well, I think it's important to back up and understand that the DEA has been very concerned with this issue for a long time. Every time they come to Beijing and they meet with their Chinese counterparts here, they have been raising not only the issue of the fentanyl epidemic in the United States, but also all of the analog compounds and substances like carfentanil, which are ravaging so many parts of the U.S. So the U.S. has been pushing for China to control these substances more aggressively for some time now. The Chinese side, for their part, has been indicating they were willing to do this. The DEA acting administrator Chuck Rosenberg was here in Beijing. After that meeting, I had a chance to speak with their spokesman, and he indicated that the Chinese were making progress on this. And today they finally have announced that they're going to pull the trigger on it.
And do we know how many of these substances make it from China to the United States? Of all the places that drugs come in from other countries, is a lot of it coming from China?
So the DEA certainly believes that a huge amount of it comes from China. It's very difficult to quantify because this is an illicit trade in many cases, particularly in the United States, it's an illicit trade. So why the DEA is characterizing it as a game changer that could save dozens or even hundreds of American lives over a given year is because simply because of a supply-demand equation, right? Can we fundamentally cut down on the amount of supply of fentanyl analogs in the United States? And I think from the DEA's point of view, from the administration's point of view, is we have to work more closely with China.
Well, and we read that in 2015, China banned some substances and they became much harder to find in the United States.
Yeah, that's certainly true. And I think that's what's so encouraging for the DEA about this move. What they see anecdotally, what they see from their experience working on this is when China decides to control substances, it does have the capacity to limit the export of these substances, right? So the Chinese government is not weak in terms of capacity of controlling the outflow of synthetic opioids. Rather, it's a matter of getting them to agree to list these substances, to ban the export of these substances, which I think is a much slower process for China.
By the way, is there an opioid problem in China?
So I think that's one of the things that we have to remember here. There's an education that has to go on from the U.S. to the Chinese side, which doesn't exist with a lot of other drugs. So take methamphetamine, for example. In the case of meth, there's a huge meth addiction problem in China. And so that makes it much easier, for the U.S., or much simpler for the U.S. and China to cooperate. On fentanyl, there's simply not nearly the scale of problem that exists in the U.S. The DEA has to come to Beijing, and they have to convince the Chinese how important this problem is, which is frankly happening thousands of miles away from them across the Pacific Ocean. So simply because the fact that it does not exist in China means that it's an uphill battle in many cases for the DEA to explain and to educate the Chinese on why this problem should matter to them as well.
That's Brian Spiegel, who is a China correspondent at The Wall Street Journal, joining us from Beijing. Brian, thank you.
Thank you.
This podcast and the following message are made possible by The Economist, from politics to business and finance, from science and technology to the arts. Readers are brought clear analysis of the issues that lie behind each week's global news stories. The Economist's content satisfies the globally curious with a distilled view of world affairs that is intelligent, insightful, and thought-provoking. Sign up for an introductory offer at economist.com/now.
One of the people Democrats hoped would be in the Senate right now is Jason Kander. He's a former Army intelligence officer who served in Afghanistan and served as Missouri's Secretary of State. But he lost the Senate race to Republican Senator Roy Blunt in November. So now he started an organization called Let America Vote. And he joins us from Kansas City. Jason Kander, welcome.
Glad to be with you.
And first of all, what is the goal of Let America Vote?
Well, Let America Vote is about engaging in and winning the public debate over voting rights or voter suppression laws. And for some time now, the Republican Party has made it a central part of their strategy to make it harder to vote if you are in the demographics that are less likely to vote for Republicans. And the way they do that is they tell fictions about voter fraud, the greatest of which, the biggest of which, has been the most recent one, which is the lie told by the president about 3 to 5 million supposedly illegal voters voting in the election. And over time, Democrats have been able to, or proponents of voting rights, have been able to hold back that assault over the last decade plus by going to court and winning most of the time. And now you have Jeff Sessions in charge of the Department of Justice, so it's switching sides in this issue. And you have President Trump appointing judges, and it becomes really important that we be able to also win the public debate, the political argument over the issue, and that's what Let America Vote is here to do.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of what you're talking about, what the Trump administration has been saying about voter fraud in the election. Here's an exchange between the president's senior policy advisor, Stephen Miller, and ABC's George Stephanopoulos.
You can't hold on a second. You just claimed again that there was illegal voting in New Hampshire. People bussed in from the state of Massachusetts. Do you have any evidence to back
anybody,
that up?
I'm saying anybody, George, go to New Hampshire, talk to anybody who's worked in politics there for a long time. Everybody's aware of the problem in New Hampshire with respect to
I'm asking you
bringing
as the White House senior hold on a second. I'm asking you as the White House senior policy advisor. The president made a statement saying he was the victim of voter fraud, people being bussed from Massachusetts to New Hampshire.
The president was.
Do you have any evidence?
And he didn't have any evidence there. But a Politico Morning Consult poll this month found that 1 in 4 voters believe that millions of votes were cast illegally in the 2016 election. Why are you losing this battle with the people? At least 1 in 4 Americans believe what the Trump administration has been saying about voter fraud.
Well, it's very hard to win a battle that you're not fighting, and that's what Let America Vote is changing. You know, what you just heard from Stephen Miller is just the sound of a man lying. I mean, it's important that we call this what it is. I mean, you know, a lot of people assign the motivation to President Trump's lie about voter fraud to his deep insecurities about the popular vote and I guess about life in general. But really, it's much deeper than that. And the reason that you have a quarter of the folks out there believing that voter fraud is happening is because they're being told that by people in power, even though it's just a complete lie. And when you have the president of the United States telling that lie on the biggest scale that it's ever been told, the reason that people like Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell will say, well, we haven't really seen evidence of that, but, you know, I mean, the president has a right to his belief is because it's really helpful to their cause if that gets out there in the ether and if people can start to believe that there's some problem there. When really the only problem that exists for Republicans is that folks who are minorities, who are disabled, who are poor, they're really unlikely to vote for Republicans. And that's a problem for Republicans. And if they can't vote, problem solved.
And worth pointing out, by the way, that those are your views on the word lie. NPR has made a decision at this point anyway not to use that word. And people can go on to NPR.org and hear all about that decision-making process. But do you think that voter ID laws are ever a good idea, Jason Kander?
Well, look, identification requirement of some kind is pretty standard across the country. But what we're talking about is not an identification requirement. And remember, identification doesn't have to be one very specific form of identification. When you are requiring people to get a form of identification that many of them, thousands, hundreds of thousands of them, don't need for any purpose in their life other than voting, then that's a poll tax. You know, here in Missouri, where I was the chief election official, the Secretary of State for 4 years, we put out reports, our my predecessor put out reports demonstrating that if an extreme photo ID bill like Wisconsin or North Carolina were put into place, then there's about 220,000 Missourians who are legal eligible voters who wouldn't be allowed to vote. These are folks who, when they go into the polling place, the poll workers know them by their first name. They live in their neighborhood. They've been coming in, voting in every election for years. And they would have to take off work, go find documents, pay money to do it, go wait in line at the DMV. And, you know, the reason that the Republicans want to push that is not because of voter fraud. I mean, the only kind of voter fraud that a photo ID requirement can even claim to prevent is voter impersonation fraud. Well, we've never had a case of that in Missouri. In fact, as an American, you are more likely to be struck by lightning than you are to commit voter impersonation fraud. And despite that, they work very hard to spend lots of taxpayer dollars to do this, and it's all just a fiction.
So Jason Kander, as we mentioned, you lost your Senate race in Missouri, but you've also been called a rising star in the Democratic Party. What are you thinking as you watch what's happening with the Trump White House right now? We've just had the Labor Secretary nominee withdraw his name for that position, Michael Flynn resigning, and we're already talking about potential congressional investigations of the White House.
Well, I think we're way behind on that. I think that if this were President Hillary Clinton, the Congress would be acting a lot faster. And if Hillary Clinton had done the things that President Donald Trump has done, they would be absolutely right to do so. Here's just one fact from the last week that I think has really gone overlooked. Given the timeline of when the Department of Justice informed the president that General Flynn was vulnerable to potential blackmail by the Russians, and given when he resigned, that means that weeks went by where the president allowed someone to have complete and total access to American intelligence at the very top of the American intelligence network. He could see anything he wants, knowing that that individual was vulnerable to blackmail by the Russians. That is an undisputed fact. And that is just one of the many reasons why the 54% of Americans who voted for somebody not named Donald Trump to be president, you know, voted the way they did. And yet he's come into office and is governing and acting as though he has this sweeping mandate. And I think that's a real error on his part. And most importantly, it's bad for the country.
So what should Democrats do?
Continue to do what we're doing. And I think the important thing here is the movement against the president, sort of what some people call the resistance, so to speak, it's not coming from Washington, which is important because if you think back on it, there's not a lot of movements in the history of this country that started in Washington and were effective. You know, I'm here in the middle of the country in Kansas City. It's where I live. And the day of the Women's March, I went down to the march in Kansas City and people came up to me, they recognized me, and they came up to me and they'd tell me that this was the first thing they'd ever done politically in their lives. They'd never stuffed an envelope, they'd never made a phone call, but they had to be there the day after the inauguration. Something is happening. And what's happening is that it is a people-powered movement of folks who are saying, you made promises in the election, and 54% of us said we didn't want those to happen, and you're acting as though it was a completely different scenario rather than trying to reach out and be president of the entire country.
What's next for you? And is it possible that you will challenge Democrat Claire McCaskill, who's up for re-election in 2018?
Well, first of all, no, that's not possible. Claire is my friend, and I'll definitely be working hard to make sure she's reelected. She's doing a great job. As to the rest of your question, I'm doing what I'm going to be doing. I mean, making sure that we fight back against a president that is actively working to undermine confidence and faith in American democracy is really important, and it deserves my attention. And that's where I'm going to be spending my time for the moment.
Have you thought about what you might run for in the future, though?
No, I really am not. You know, anytime I've ever had my name on a ballot, it has been because there was a change that I wanted to see. And between me and making that change happen, there happened to be an office. You know, I'm a person who believes in doing something, not in being something. And right now I'm working very hard and have been throughout my career working on doing something. And if ever again there's a point where there's an office between me and accomplishing the change that I want to see, then I might run. But that's not something that I'm thinking about.
Have you thought about who should lead the Democratic National Committee?
I have talked with several of them, had lunch or other meetings with several of them, and I think we got some great candidates.
But you haven't picked one?
I have not. There's some real good people, though. I think we're going to be in good hands.
That's Jason Kander, who is the former Secretary of State in Missouri, former Senate candidate, and now has started this group, Let America Vote. We'll link you to more about that at hereandnow.org. Jason, thank you.
Thank you so much.
In cities across the country, some restaurants are closed today. Students are skipping class and workers are staying home. It's part of a strike that's being called a Day Without Immigrants, a response to President Donald Trump's immigration policies. Andy Shalal is the owner of Busboys and Poets restaurants. All six of his restaurants in the Washington, D.C. area are closed today. And he joins us now. And Andy, so for you, what does a day without immigrants look like?
It will be a day without any business. So we decided to stand in solidarity with the folks that work with us, that work for us, that come as our customers as well, and say, you know what, this is a day that we need to highlight the importance and the significance of immigrants in our community.
Mm. Out of curiosity, the restaurants are closed today, but are your workers still getting paid?
You know, all of our workers have options to be able to use. They have paid sick leave. They have paid time off. So we've encouraged them to use any of those times that they have.
Mm. You came to the United States from Iraq with your family as a boy?
Yes.
Tell me more about that.
Well, it was 1966. We came here to this country. And I have to tell you, when I hear some of the conversations that are going on to make America great again, I remember in 1966 when we came here, one of the most starkest things that I ever heard was it was illegal for a black person and a white person to marry in the state of Virginia. We lived in Virginia at that time. It was only 2 years before that that the Civil Rights Act was passed, and a year before that, the Voting Rights Act. So making America great again, for whom and how? You know, America's progressed so much since we came here back in 1966. And certainly as a place to the idea of immigrants, you know, we are starting to recognize that we are a melting pot of all different cultures, and we are finally beginning to understand and appreciate the value of the diversity. Mm. I definitely don't want to go back.
You know, I've spoken with many people over the past year who say that they're not opposed to immigration, but their concern aren't so much the immigrants themselves, but they feel, whether rightly or wrongly, they feel that the government hasn't been adequately focused on helping Americans, and that immigration only exacerbates that problem. What's your response to that? I'm sure you've heard similar conversations.
Well, I think we as a country have to address the idea of immigration reform in a really serious way. This is not just something we can keep kicking down the road, hoping it's going to go away and it's going to change. As long as there are wars, as long as there are difficulties in other parts of the world, people are going to try to come to America. And we have to make it possible for people to come here in a humane way, not in a draconian way where you're building up higher walls and hiring more agents and putting up more detention centers. This is a human issue. Yeah. Every immigrant has a story. People don't want to leave where they're from unless it's impossible to live there. And oftentimes, I think we have to address the circumstances that sometimes I think the United States has created that has caused people to be forced to leave from their countries.
Andy, I wonder if you could tell us a quick story here, because recently at the inauguration, in fact, there was a supporter of President Trump who came into one of your restaurants and ended up leaving a $450 tip.
Yes.
Can you tell us about that?
These were, I believe, three Trump supporters. They had the Make America Great Again hats that they put under their, you know, their arm when they walked in, recognizing that they may be in a place that may not be so supportive. And they sat down, and a young lady, this beautiful black waitress, took care of them. And this is Rosalind. She's always been wonderful to every customer that walks through the door. And she gave them great service and had a beautiful smile and all this. And one of them was a dentist and commented about how beautiful her smile was. And she thanked him. And they hit it off really nicely. And at the end, they wrote a $450 tip on a $70 check. And when I heard the gentleman interviewed afterwards, he was actually profoundly moved. He had tears in his eyes talking about it. And I couldn't help but feel that maybe this is the first time he's had an encounter like this.
Yeah.
You know, people live in isolated communities. I know that. So it's possible this was his first time. And imagine if this is repeated over and over again, where people can intersect with each other, what a different world it would be.
Hmm. So I'm looking at a picture of the receipt. And he wrote, "We may come from different cultures and may disagree on certain issues, but if everyone would share their smile and kindness like your beautiful smile, our country will come together as one people, not race, not gender, just American." And he told the press later that interacted like regular human beings. And I
know, which was, you know, in some ways you want to be offended by that, but in other ways, you know, you have to say, you know what, this is what it takes. Sometimes
right.
It's just these moments that transform people. And sometimes we don't really give each other an opportunity to express our humanity. We still live in a very segregated country, unfortunately. You know, I mean, even in Washington, D.C., where I live, places of worship are segregated, restaurants are segregated. And we pride ourselves, actually, at Busboys and Poets, to make sure that we are not such a place, because we want to make sure that these moments that you just read are not just isolated moments, but they happen all the time.
Well, Andy Shalal is the founder of Busboys and Poets. He closed all six of his restaurants in Washington, Maryland, and Virginia in honor of the Day Without Immigrants. Andy Shalal, thank you so very much for joining us.
It's been a joy to talk to you. Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.